Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 581, The Blues Brothers. How about that? Which,
Wildstone.
Before you get too excited about The Blues Brothers, with our current format, that means coming up next is The Blues Brothers 2000.
So. Yeah, it's not. It doesn't bode well. This is not to have a good ending.
Yes.
Much like The Blues Brothers 2000.
Sometimes you got to take the good with the bad. Sometimes you got to take the good with the mediocre. So,
and here we are.
Here we are. So, you have all three. You have the Blues Brothers, which is good. You have Blues Brothers 2000, which is bad, and you have us, which is mediocre. So let's.
I think we're a little on the upper side of mediocre, maybe.
let's go around the virtual table, and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts. You can go there, rate, review, subscribe. Be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Wherever you're getting your podcast from, you should be able to find us, whether it's iHeart or Spotify or Stitcher or Spreaker, as Kevin likes me to say.
Thank you.
It's been a while.
I haven't heard that word in a while.
So you should be able to find us. If you find us on a platform where you're not finding us, let us know so we can be found. Yeah, that's how
we can fix it.
We'll fix it. So also, check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. The group is much more communal and friendly. You should give that a shot. And, of course, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month, you can help us out, and we greatly appreciate it. So there is all of that. Let's tackle the Blues Brothers.
Do you want to do the League of Show Shares?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I even wrote them up. Like, some weeks I forget to do them. I forgot to do the League of Show Shares. Thank you, Joe. That was the awkward silence. So, when you're on our Facebook page, if you would share an episode, that would be amazing. And you could join the League of Show Shares. People who were kind enough to share the show this week, Dustin at Nerds at Night Gaming, Chris Valls, Carl Clarkson, Griffin Fox Smith, Ralph Tribble, Brent Smith, Lane LeVanway, Julianne Jordan, Chris Williams, Tammy Sherman Powers, Travis Tewitt, Heather Sachs, Ron Johnson, Jason Lafferty, Gabriel Lugo, Chris Magic Man, Dylan A. Lang, Douglas Bulldog, Chris Sanders, and Susan Carlson. So thank you very much, gender neutral guys, for...
Are there two new ones in there?
There are. I believe Chris Valls is new and Jason Lafferty.
Oh, that's awesome. Welcome to the group.
Yeah.
And Chris, I also saw my friend Jeff Michael shared the Gremlins 2 show, and so maybe his privacy settings don't show up, but I saw he shared it. So thanks, Jeff.
Yes, thank you. If you're depending on how your privacy settings are, like sometimes I won't be able to see you. So if you've been sharing, and we haven't said this for a while, if you've been sharing and you're not hearing your name, it's because I can't see it. So you either need to adjust your privacy settings or send me a friend request at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe, and then you will pop up on my Facebook page when you share said episode. So there.
Ha.
Nah. So yeah, Chris Valls got a little inside baseball treatment because he shared Gremlins, and he was like, really want to hear my name in Gremlins 2, and it's like, yeah, so about
well?
That. Yeah. So we typically record two at a time, so that's why you only hear the show sharers every other episode. There's a little peeling back the curtain.
Yeah, even more peeling back.
Yeah, if we peel it back much. Yeah, if we peel back much more, everyone will know that Joe doesn't wear pants.
Well, when now that we're at home,
right?
Right. Yeah. That's that. Yeah, that's well.
Yeah, it's I wear pants all night. I'm not wearing pants more.
One of the perks. So, yeah. The Blues Brothers. So this, I guess this was the first official SNL spinoff film, right? The first film that grew out of an SNL character. So SNL at this point in time had already flexed their muscle at the box office because people felt like Animal House was very much an SNL driven film, even though it really
was it.
Well, I mean, it had Belushi, but it was also written by a lot. You know, it was created and by a lot of National Lampoon writers who had kind of discovered a lot, a lot of those early SNL cast members had obviously come out of Second City, but they had also been in a touring group called National Lampoon's Lemmings. And so people who had been in the Lemmings would be like Belushi and Chevy Chase and Bill Murray, Brian Doyle Murray. There's a lot of people that were in the Lemmings, Gilda Radner, that would go on to be on SNL.
Sure.
And so and Animal House was, I mean, you just cannot overstate how big of a hit it was and how much of a surprise it was. Like, nobody saw that movie becoming the juggernaut that it was. And so then after that, people were clamoring for, like, oh, this is the new generation of comedians, in much the same way, but I would argue in a larger sense, in much the same way when 40-year-old virgin took off.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's
Everybody wanted that kind of comedy. That's what happened with Animal House.
I feel like Old School is that movie. I feel like Old School is like the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a bridge between those two worlds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I don't think Old School had the popularity of 40-year-old virgin, though.
Oh, I think it did.
It was a hit, certainly, but I don't think it was like a cultural. It tapped into the cultural zeitgeist in quite the same way 40-year-old virgin did.
Yeah,
personally.
I don't think so.
Yeah, and
you think? I mean, people still say I'm going, like, the whole I'm going streaking line is still a line.
Well, they can say anything they want, but it doesn't mean. So Old School made $87 million and 40-Year-Old Virgin made $177 million.
Yeah, but my point was Old School is the Blade of these movies. Old School is the one that said, oh, these are marketable. People like these. They like the people that are in them. I mean, those guys went on to do what? It was Old School and Wedding Crashers and wasn't there another one? There was another one.
Can't remember.
They did those guys did a bunch of movies together.
Yeah, because didn't they do like? Did they end up doing like Starsky and Hutch? And
yeah, that was definitely Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson. But this is like the Vince Vaughn, the breakup was them, was like those John Favreau, those guys, and then there was the Judd Apatow stuff, which was undeniable, and then that kind of spun into the. Who's the Todd Phillips stuff. So like there was these three different, like, not, I wouldn't call them genres, but like three different styles of like those rated R comedies.
Well, Todd Phillips did Old School.
That's Old School. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
that's true. That's right. That's right. I don't know why I was thinking that was Judd Apatow.
And a lot of times a quick shorthand to figure out which camp it is. If it's got Dan Finnerty and the Dan Band in it, it's one of those movies. You know what I mean? Because he's in Old School.
Right,
he's in Starsky and Hutch. He has a song in the soundtrack for the first Hangover. I feel like there's a third one that he pops up in. But
he's in Wedding Crashers.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And Old School.
Right. Well, yeah. Old School is what really kind of got him noticed because they're doing the Total Eclipse of the Heart, which is so good. But I really feel like that was a bridge because, Old School is funny, but it's a little bit more. I would consider Dodgeballs in that world. Where Apatow was more like it would be raunchy, but it also had like kind of this sentimentality about it that you don't
There's a heart to it.
Yeah, that you don't really get from Old School. But anyway, But Animal House is like just basically like was just lit a stick of dynamite under Hollywood, and then everybody won. And you would see kind of two movies. You would see movies that had SNL cast members in them that were trying to replicate what Animal House did. And then you would see movies that just thought, well, let's just be raunchy and zany and that's enough. And that's where you would get the, you know, Porky's and Ski Patrol. And well, no, Meatballs, I mean, it's got SNL pedigree. It's got yeah. Bill Murray. It's got, and it's not necessarily SNL, but he gets pulled into this world. It's directed by Ivan Reitman. It's written by Harold Ramis. So it's definitely,
oh, that's true.
It's definitely got that SNL Second City. It basically, comedy went away from being written by joke writers and got taken over by sketch and improv, right?
Like funny writers.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just a different kind of funny, you know?
Yeah, I get it. And it is more, a different kind of funny, yeah.
And it's more organic. There's so many of those kind of jokes that you can't necessarily write. Like, they kind of come out of your head as you're playing with other people.
Right.
You know?
Right, right, right.
And you would see that a lot on Caddyshack. I mean, you know, like, some of it's written, man. But a lot of it's just... It's made up on the spot, or they use that as, you know, they use what was on the page as a starting point, and then they just go crazy.
Go.
Yeah. So, Blues Brothers comes at a time when Belushi's career is trending downward, right? He had just done,
yeah.
Him and Aykroyd had both just left SNL, so they were no longer cast members. Belushi was going to go be a big movie star and teams up with the hottest director in Hollywood, Steven Spielberg, to make what is arguably his worst film, 1941. It's one of his most critically reviled films, and it's also, but that's subjective. But I think it's still to this day probably his biggest box office failure. And
Spielberg or Belushi?
Spielberg. Well, sure. Probably Belushi as well, although Neighbors really tanked, but it didn't cost as much. But he was struggling. So he, you know, so nobody really knew what to make of this movie. It was a one joke sketch on SNL. It evolved out of kind of two separate sketches, right? So, the look of it evolved out of Aykroyd and Belushi playing, bodyguards for Chevy Chase's version of Gerald Ford. They would wear the suits, right, and the sunglasses and have a briefcase. But the musical portion of it originally began life. They were dressed up as the Bees from the famous Killer Bee sketch that they did on SNL. Oh. So the first time you see the Blues Brothers perform as a musical act, they are dressed as Bees. And then at some point, those two things kind of merge. I believe it was the musical director of SNL at the time, I think his name's Howard Shore, was like, oh, we, you know, like, you should look like this, but do that. But even then, they never really told you on SNL. They never really used them in a sketch. They would just come out and perform songs, kind of.
That's the best part.
Yeah, with kind of no explanation. But they were huge. I mean, I don't know that a lot of people realize, especially younger people, realize that, like, the Blues Brothers' success predates the movie, and it wasn't just limited to they were characters on SNL that people liked. I mean,
like,
you know, they,
albums and stuff.
They had a Briefcase Full of Blues came out in 1978 and went to number one on the charts, produced at least one top 20 single, their version of Soul Man. So they were a viable touring entity. They were touring and playing, and people were going to see them. And I also think like Aykroyd kind of gets credit for the blues revival. Like, part of the reason he wanted to do this was because he loved the blues, but the blues were very much in a fallow period. Most of these blues musicians were playing like rundown bars. Like, they weren't, like, nowadays they're considered legends, but at that moment in time, like, music had really moved on. And
I feel like Blues Brothers 2000 helped put it back in the grave.
Yeah, I know, right? Like it's yeah. And but let's
well, clearly they were all available to do a movie, so
yeah. Let's not get well. Now they weren't all available. There was no John Candy or Belushi or Cab Calloway.
Yeah, right. But, right.
No, but the, but most of the blues musicians were more than happy to do these movies.
So they were. I mean, most of. I think by the second one, they wanted to be in it because the first one was so big, and so it felt like a badge of honor.
Yeah.
Like if you weren't in the movie, you didn't count. But that first one was basically just Aykroyd picking his favorite guys and putting them in a movie and basically picking them up from the ash can of history and dusting them off and making them relevant again. It's also there's also then been kind of a twist. Back where people are like, I feel like you feel this more in the second one. Like the first one is like about a love of this, and the second one becomes almost like a condescending fetishization of it. You know,
yeah, it's weird. Like the first one is definitely it's an interesting movie because it's a road movie, but it's also a musical. It's also a comedy, so it's got it ticks like all these different boxes.
Action movie.
Without question. Yeah, big time. Where the second one, I agree, it feels like it's almost making fun of the first one. It's almost like a parody of the first one.
I mean, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but the second
one is
basically just a remake of the first one in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In a lot
it's
of very frustrating
movie.
Ways. Yeah. But
more offensive?
Yeah, and just Yeah, just lazier. But anyway, so back to this one. So when this movie came out, like people didn't they did not know what to expect, and it was a very troubled production, a famously production, and went infamously over budget, and they basically destroyed downtown Chicago filming it. They cost the mayor
how they did some of that stuff.
They just did it is
flabbergasting.
They just did it.
Yeah. That's some like punk rock filmmaking where Landis is coming off of Animal House like 2 years prior, and he like I just feel like he kind of had like this punk rock attitude where he's just like, we're just gonna do it, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't work, you know, not saying that he didn't care about his career, but you know, I think he'd put out Kentucky Fried Movie and Schlock at that point,
right?
So like His career wasn't exact. I mean, Animal House was a career defining moment. So it's like, but it wasn't like he had a career to lose at that point.
Well, yeah. So if you don't have a future, I'm sure he wanted a future in Hollywood, though.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, he was a hot director.
I'm sure that he did, but at the same time, he's still so new. He's just like, let's just go for it and see what happens.
I think a lot of it was he was so new, he didn't always know how the toes he was stepping on, so he better be right.
True.
And he ended up being right. But he was a hot director. I mean, he had been attached coming into this movie. He had been attached to Lily Tomlin's The Incredible Shrinking Woman. Now that movie ended up not being all that big of a deal, and it's kind of been lost to time. And you look at it and you go, Belushi, Aykroyd, or Lily Tomlin, who cares? But Lily Tomlin was a very, very big deal at this point in time. She had television specials that were huge. She had been on a very successful sketch show as well called Laughing, and honestly they probably would have considered her the bigger star because her show was in prime time where SNL was literally the not ready for prime time player, so on paper that's the bigger, safer movie. It's the bigger, safer movie star or potential for being a movie star. So for Landis to leave that to come do this, that in and of itself was a bit of a
bold move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big time. Big time.
So how much did they cost the city of Chicago, Tom? You were saying something when Joe cut in.
Oh, what I was going to no, I was going to say that they cost the mayor of Chicago her reelection bid. Like she had signed off on this and then they had just done so much disruption to Chicago. Oh. People were mad at her. And a lot of people credit that with being why she didn't win re-election.
Well, I hope they didn't watch this movie then.
Well, you know what the irony is now this is probably like the most like iconic Chicago movie right. ever made, even more so than
Easily.
Chicago.
Easily.
Like, and they have statues to these guys, and they wear this movie like a badge of honor. But
say,
at the time, like, they were just like, we can't believe you're letting them drive cars through Daly Plaza. And, like, they were just doing so much destruction throughout the city of Chicago that, that people just got sick of it. You know?
Yeah, I love seeing it, though, all those landmarks. I mean, as someone, you know, we live only 5 hours from Chicago here in St. Louis, and I always love to do weekend trips there, and it's a fun place. And to be able to see all these landmarks and especially have it be a time capsule of a time before I ever went there, it's really neat to see.
There's a look to this movie that we will never see again. Like, there is a grit and grime to this movie
absolutely
that we'll never see.
And I think that's the lack of that is a lot of what makes Blues Brothers 2000 not work.
I agree.
This movie has this kind of lived in, like, you can just feel the grime on this movie in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's none of that in the second. Absolutely
none of it. No,
it's
very clean.
It's too polished.
It looks like a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah,
we talk about that when a movie is just too clean and too polished and it doesn't look real. And this movie looks like a lot of the movies that were filmed in 70s, 80s New York, where you get that dirty, grimy, lived-in feel. And yeah, you miss something with that one. But it's an interesting movie. I had never seen it before.
Really? You'd never seen Blues Brothers before?
No, I mean, I'd seen the SNL skits, but I mean, I just never got around to seeing the movie.
No, I get it. We all have those things that get by us, but it's such a big movie. It surprises me.
Yeah, that is very, I didn't, okay, that's a very interesting move.
I don't really care about blues music. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't really do much for me.
I'm the same way. I don't either, and I think that the song selection in this movie is perfect.
Yeah.
Like, you don't. Like, these are the kind of blues songs that you don't have to like the blues to enjoy.
Right.
And they do such a good job of making these guys just cool.
Like, those two are what saved the movie. As in, if it was just a movie about blues music, it wouldn't be that interesting to me. Their charisma, their friendship, just their characters are so interesting and
quirky.
Yeah, I mean, these two make it, and I think it's clear, it's hard not to get into the second one, but we're going to end up talking about one of the missing elements of the second one.
Sure.
That's apparent. And so it's these two guys are what make, you know, as great as some of the actors are in the second one, it's just like this chemistry is what made this movie enjoyable. And I did like their dynamic for sure.
It's a movie that succeeds in spite of itself. You know, it's such a troubled production. It's chaos. On paper, this movie should not function. It's virtually plotless.
Right.
You know, it's like we need to raise money by doing a by putting on a show, and then
that we have to do legally. Like,
and then there's a
that's it. That's the end of the plot.
Yeah, and then there's a car chase, and the movie's over. And like nothing about this should work.
And we call it a day.
Yeah, and I think some of it comes from the fact that like it was overwritten and then pared down. You know, and
oh,
so
sure.
the screenplay. Supposedly, I think it was Landis. The screenplay was so long, he actually had it rebound with the cover of the phone book on it just to mess with. Because the original screenplay, I think, was like 324 pages. Like, Aykroyd had written like this huge, elaborate backstory for who they were and how they got there and why they were the way they were and where the car came from and all this stuff. And
so how did we never get a prequel? How did no one ever try? How did Aykroyd not try to cash in on that?
Well, I mean, you know, he tried to get, I think, you know, Blues Brothers off the ground for a long time. And I like a sequel, but I think that it was also, you know, Belushi died, you know, what, in 81 or 82.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he didn't really live long enough for them to make a true sequel. And so I think for a long time, there was just, you know, it was just a non-starter for him. Like,
sure.
It was, how do you do, you know,
I guess that's the advantage of this property.
There's only one movie that stars Lou Costello by himself for a reason.
Yeah. Right.
But I guess that's the advantage of him, like, I guess owning the property is unlike, I don't know, what was it? Oh, Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
Like, wasn't the there was that weird prequel that was in there that Dan Aykroyd could say, no, we're not doing that. Like, we're not casting two people that kind of look like us when we were younger.
Yeah.
you know, so right. That's kind of an advantage. But I agree, like, there's, I feel like when we get to Blues Brothers 2000 and there's a missed opportunity there, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of interest, like things that they don't do that I feel like they could have done given the information we had from this one. But if there's enough for a third movie, I mean, you know, I don't think I guess they're working on Ghostbusters.
I'm just surprised it hasn't been rebooted. I mean, even up until this day with Chris Hemsworth is one of them or something. You know what I mean? Like how they do with the prequels. I'm really surprised they haven't cashed in on that. If he has the story written and he's been sitting on it, but
I'm sure that he does. I wonder, Aykroyd, I feel like, is one of those guys that when, knock on wood, when he passes away, there's going to be like, oh, I had 7 Ghostbusters movies written, ready to go. Or I had like 5 more of these. I had 2 more Coneheads. Like, I feel like there's going to be like, they're going to open the vault like Marcellus Wallace's case. And it's just going to start glowing with all of these different scripts.
Yeah, but I also think that most of them probably aren't going to be very good. I mean, as much as...
No, I agree.
As much as Aykroyd has done some amazing things, he's also done a lot of really bad things.
Bad things.
I mean, you know, you got the Coneheads movie and Nothing But Trouble.
Coneheads to me gets a pass. You do not disparage the name of Nothing But Trouble.
That movie's awful.
I love that movie.
And
it's so bonkers. It's Doctor so bonkers.
Dr. Detroit. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
that's not good.
In his defense, Dr. Detroit, I believe, was the first movie he made after Belushi died. And so was kind of a little rudderless. Like, he just didn't know what to do. And then he makes Dr. Detroit and that really tanks. And then his next movie is Trading Places. And then that kind of,
come on.
Yeah. I mean, but, and that's great, but it really has not a whole lot to do with him.
It does not. Jamie Lee Curtis and Eddie Murphy. Those are the two plus sides of that movie.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to mention 2 other plus sides.
Yeah.
I said Jamie Lee Curtis.
Well, I know, but
yeah. So, but yeah, let's dig into this actual movie itself.
This is one of those ones that, I've seen a bunch of times, but never really, I guess, like, sat down and watched. This is, I'm just trying to, like, in the Landis universe, I guess, like, this is kind of like his coming out party. So, we're introduced to Jake and Elwood Blues, and Jake is getting out of jail. And of course, who do we see giving Jake the property? But
Frank Oz,
who is a staple in almost all of Landis's movies. He's always showing up, which I just like. It's one of those weird crossovers that like they must be buddies.
Yeah.
In real life. So it's just like every time you see a Landis movie, or you're going to see Frank Oz.
I always love when Frank Oz pops up and stuff like stuff that he doesn't direct, you know, because
and then he
great.
Talks to you like it's Fozzie Bear. Like his voice is Fozzie Bear. Like,
yeah, that's that was his natural speaking voice.
Yeah. Right. So they get out of jail and they're just going back home. And I do like where they're going back and forth in the car. And for whatever reason, I always thought that they both talk to each other in like that monotone voice. I don't know why that clicked in my head, but they don't. Like, it's just like two brothers having a conversation. Dan Aykroyd lays on the thickest Chicago accent he possibly can, where Belushi's just like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, that's, I'm not putting that accent on. So just kind of going back and forth about.
He sold
the Cadillac to get a microphone.
To get a microphone, yeah.
He had to pay some money to get the cop car. And
it looks like just a piece of junk.
It's an old cop car. Like, it's an old beat up cop car that looks like it was in like Demolition Derby, yeah.
Yeah.
So they go back to the orphanage where they were raised because they're orphans. And we see this nun who kind of tells them, look, we're going to lose this orphanage. It's going to get transferred to the Board of Education if we can't come up with $5,000. And I do love how Belushi's like, yeah, we'll get you $5,000 right now. Not a problem.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, I have to get it legally. And he was like, oh.
Can't help you. See you
that
later.
This to me is like some of the like Landis. I always feel like was really good at one point at throwing in like some vaudeville slapstick. So the the two brothers just keep cussing.
Literally slapstick?
Literally slapstick, yeah. So the two brothers keep cussing, and of course, the nun, like, every time the nun hits them, they cuss again. It's just like this back and forth for like 2 minutes of them just getting hit by this nun. And it works in this movie. When it comes back later in the next one, it falls flat. Like, there's just nothing there.
Yeah,
I don't agree.
You agree that it works?
I thought it was hilarious when she whips out that metal extension. Like, I thought that was a great callback. I enjoyed it.
That, well, that's all that movie is callbacks.
We'll get to it. You're right, exactly. That's the problem.
So, yeah, so they find, they're like, "What? We don't know what to do." So they both decide, we're just going to get the band back together. And the next hour of this movie is them trying to get their old band back together. So they've got to go.
It's the Muppet movie.
It is kind of the Muppet movie.
I feel like whenever you see a movie where they're getting a crew together, this is where you get the phrase getting the band back together from. I guess maybe a movie did this before. I mean, getting your crew together for a big mission, isn't a new thing. I mean, Seven Samurai did it, but
the Muppet movie is before this, and this is the exact same thing.
Well, is it before this?
I'm trying to think.
Oh, I guess it is.
Yeah,
Muppet movie's before this, and it's the same plot of getting everyone back together. So I'd say they pretty much copied that, plot.
Yeah, I mean, the Muppet movie came out in 79, so like I mean, they were essentially in production at the same time. You know what I mean? So
a year apart. I mean,
yeah,
but
either way,
yeah. And the Muppets were on SNL.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Did they go get the maitre d'? It doesn't matter. They're just going around and picking up their guys.
Are all their guys real blues musicians then?
What's that?
I thought so.
Are all the guys in their band real life famous blues musicians?
They're real life. The most of them are session musician ringers. They weren't blues legends.
But if you were a blues guy though, these guys would be, you would have heard them on stuff that you listened to.
Yeah. Like I think two of them were in Blood, Sweat and Tears for a while. Although if you ever want to just make yourself laugh, go look at the list, go to Wikipedia, look up Blood, Sweat and Tears and look at the list of people who were in it. There's like literally been like 150 people who've been in that band over the years, but they were in the band when it was relevant,
Sure.
And then I think a couple others, I think were in the SNL band, a house band, which is a smoking band, but Paul Schaefer was originally the keyboard player, but he couldn't do the film because he was attached to Gilda Radner was doing a show on Broadway and they were turning it into a live film and he was attached to that, and so he couldn't go be in the film, which is how you get the keyboard player who's in the movie because it's supposed to be Paul Schaefer.
Well, don't worry, we get Paul Schaefer later.
Oh, I'm worried. Yeah. Yes. But one of the things that didn't work for me in this movie and the next one is all these, like, I felt like they were winking at me cameos of like getting the band together and all these people. Like, I don't know blues musicians, so I just felt like it was like, especially the next one, but is like, you know what I mean? That doesn't work for me when they pick them up and they're like, oh, let's join. Like, there was nothing exciting about that to me because
I don't think you're not supposed to know, I think, who the members of the Blues Brothers band are. Like, those aren't supposed to be like fun cameos. The fun cameos are, James Brown is the preacher and Ray Charles at the music store. And
Aretha Franklin at the diner.
Right, yeah. Aretha Franklin and is it Bo Diddley playing guitar on the street? Like, those are the... Those are Cab Calloway at the end. Like those are the are the cameos. The band themselves is basically they cast actual musicians instead of having it overdubbed, and that's also why some of the acting from them is pretty wonky. But they're not asked to do a whole lot.
but they
wanted real playing up there on that stage.
So do they go to the maitre d' first? Is that who the first guy they go after? Because I think they said like if we can get him, the rest will kind of fall into place. So they go to this very posh restaurant, and of course there's the maitre d', and he's like, "Oh no, I'm not doing this again. I'm making good money." And they're like, "Nope, that's fine. This is very Beverly Hills Cop, where they're like, nope, it's fine. They go in and they, of course, just start not wreaking havoc, but making life very difficult for
like,
the patrons.
Like, we're going to eat here every day until you say yes.
Yeah.
We'll do breakfast, lunch, and dinner here. And he was like, all right, fine, fine, I'll go.
Get a young Paul Rubens here.
Paul Rubens was the waiter.
Oh, I didn't notice Paul Rubens. Wow.
And that scene. Yeah, he's the waiter who walks up with the Dom Perignon. And I do love where he's like, that's the wrong glass. He's like, I don't care.
Yeah.
He's like, whatever.
A pre Pee-wee Paul Rubens. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's kind of like, I think the other big get here is their guitar player, who is, I think it's Mike or Mark Murphy.
Matt.
Matt
Murphy.
Matt Murphy. Who is, you know, working in a diner, and of course he immediately sees the boys walk in, and he hears their order. So Elwood, Dan Aykroyd, orders just toast, white toast, that's it. And Belushi orders like the fried chicken. Just from their order, he knew who they were, and of course he comes out.
He orders four full fried chickens.
Four fried chickens and a Coke and an order of dry white chicken.
I like how she's like, do you want wings or thighs? And he's like, four
fried chickens.
Fried chickens.
And a Coke. There's actually a Blues Brothers tribute band called Four Fried Chickens and a Coke.
Four fried chickens.
Oh, nice.
That's great. So of course, Matt immediately knows who it is. He comes out, and Aretha Franklin's like, oh no, we are not doing this. The James Brown cameo, where they go to the Baptist church, because that's where Cab Calloway told them to go.
That's where he gets the inspiration,
sees the light.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's what we have to do to raise this money. So Aretha Franklin breaks into Respect.
Think. There's no, she's, you better
oh,
think.
Oh, think.
What
yeah,
you're
yeah,
doing
yeah.
To me.
Cause
yeah.
Matt's like, yeah, I'm out of here. I'm not, you know, he realized, and of course, I love the trumpet player or the trombone player who's like watching from the background and then just like takes his hair down, and all of a sudden he's like standing on the. There's a lot of scenes that if this was a straight up musical, I would hate this movie.
Right. It has this weird way of pulling it off without being fantasy sequences, but also being completely unrealistic. It's
completely unrealistic.
It's, I mean, like I said, on paper, nothing about this movie should work.
No, you're absolutely. Yeah, you're totally right.
I was very confused not having seen it before, because I'm like, what type of movie is this?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yes. To answer your question, Kevin, yes.
But you know what it did do is I thought, wow, it would be really fun to go to that church. I don't know, like, like that's like the, it just looked like they were all having a crazy time and doing flips through the aisle. Like, you know, like it made it look like, holy cow, what an insane thing to be at, you know?
It's weird when we get to the second one, where it's like, oh, they just, all right, we're just doing the same flips, same everything.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, brutal.
So they get the maitre d', they get Matt, they get the rest of the, they break in, and then Aretha Franklin's like, you better think about this before you walk out that door. And he's like, cool, and grabs his guitar and just walks out the door. And of course, the trumpet player is sitting on the counter, and she's like, all right, you can go too. And he just like jumps up like a lost puppy and takes off.
Who's working at that cafe anymore?
Right.
Nope. Aretha Franklin. That's it.
All her people left.
Yeah. Right. Right. So they get the band back together and they're traveling across to, like pimp this show. Basically we have to get people in for the show. They do this hilarious thing where they show up at this like country western bar, and I feel
this is
kind of
classic.
The iconic scene of the movie.
Yeah.
Besides the car chase, like the car chase is insane.
It's crazy.
Like that might be one of the best car chases I've ever seen. Because it's all practical. There's nothing. They're not pulling any punches with that car chase.
You have to appreciate how many cars they destroyed.
103,
without question. 103.
It was a record at the time. It stood until Blues Brothers 2000. They wreck 100.
Yeah.
They wreck 104.
Gross. That's yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the car chase is just insane. So they get to this country western bar, and I love the guy's like, what kind of music do you want us to play? And she's like, well, two kinds, country and western. He's like, all right. we'll have to figure that out. That's another thing I don't think you'll ever see anymore is like the band behind the chicken wire fence.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is a thing anymore. You know, like, I just feel like that's a very 60s, 70s thing where you're in a bar. You're like, yeah, you got to stand behind this chicken wire. It's the only thing that's going to protect you from these glass bottles that they're going to they are going to hurl at you. So they get up there and they start doing a blues song. And of course, the crowd turns on them immediately and they realize we got to do something. So they do the theme from Rawhide.
Right. Which is like the only I mean,
win them over.
Which is great because Rawhide was this huge hit show from, you know, the 50s, from what, late 50s, early 60s. And it's the, you know, it's going to be like one of two country songs that they know, you know.
Right.
Like
right. So they do it. And of course, they win the crowd back. And then they're just like, can't stand by your or stand by your man. And of course, that wins them over big time. And you've got all of the couples that are together. And I love the one guy who's like
crying
by himself, crying, just, you know, tears into his beer. So they kill, they slay, the show works out great. And then the bar owner comes up and he's like, yeah, you owe me. And of course the, both the Blues Brothers are like, what? He's like, yeah, for the, you know, for the beer
for
that
all
you
the
drank,
beer.
Like you
Which,
owe me.
This is something clubs do to bands a lot. Like that's,
is it really?
That's a real thing. Yeah.
Oh man. That's crazy. Bands.
Yeah.
And the guys are just like, yeah, he's like, I just thought that they were, you know, on the house. He's like, no. Those were not on the house. So they're actually going to come out in the red on this
$100.
$100, yeah, for two beers. Like, I only see them drink two beers.
No, if you look at the stage, it's littered with beer.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Did we mention yet that Carrie Fisher is, like, attacking Jake?
Oh, no, yes. She's constantly trying to murder Jake.
Which I thought was a hilarious subplot.
I did see her and I was like, oh man. So are we in the middle of Star Wars at this? We are in the middle of Star Wars.
This movie, Blues Brothers, opened the same day as Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
They would That's never tough. Let that happen today.
No. Absolutely not. We have The Hangover 4 up against the new Star Wars movie. They're like, we're going to move Hangover 4. That's
well, not only that, but she's in both movies. They would never let two major movies with the same major actor open simultaneously.
I don't know, though, because I remember there was
something like that.
They did. There was a movie that had like two Ryan Reynolds movies or something open. There was a weird thing where it was like, wow, he's in both the new movies this weekend. I do remember it.
Yeah, I'm trying to. There was one, and it was like, did one get held for a while, and they finally put it out or something? Or
I can't. I wish I remembered because I didn't look it up or anything. But I do recall that it was weird.
But that would be almost impossible to achieve today.
Was it Life and Deadpool 2?
It might. There was something. I can't remember. I really can't.
Yeah, because there was also a reason where it was like, it might have been because it was like he was barely in Life. And
I think those were both February movies. I do think that sounds familiar now. Or okay. It might have, maybe they were like weekend after one another. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But did you guys mention, when I froze up earlier, did you mention the mall? Did they build all that to destroy, or was it like an old mall?
So it was an old mall that had been abandoned. Or closed for a year. And then they rented it and dressed up. They went out and they bought a bunch of all the, like the toys and stuff that you see, like that's they had to go all and buy all that stuff just to make the mall look like
I wonder why their budget was so insane.
Well, also they literally had a line item in their budget for cocaine, so there was that.
No way.
Yeah, they had budgeted for coke in the film. Yes.
Jeez. The thing that's impressive about this movie, I mean, because we already talked about the cop cars, now we're talking about the malls, like what blew me away was the amount of destruction, just pure destruction without obviously any CG type of stuff. It's all practical, but they're really destroying things. Like when it comes to a mall, I mean, it makes sense. You're like, okay, well, it had to be an abandoned mall. But like you said, like those stores were full. They had products. They had to go out and buy stuff to destroy. And it just seems so, I guess, wasteful. It's like the fact that they they just did so much. They spent so much money on stuff to then destroy it. It's a very odd way of filmmaking. I mean, it made for some interesting shots, but I just can't see them today ever doing
It would never happen.
You know?
Yeah, they actually they had to film a lot of the car chase stuff twice because, like, they had got special permission to film driving over 100 miles an hour in Chicago. And so they were allowed to shoot to do two runs at that speed, and that they filmed it once. They didn't have any extras around because it was, you know, they were like, well, that could be dangerous. And they ended up having to go get extras and refilm it because they were driving so fast that it looked fake. They like it looked like they took something and sped it up because there was not there wasn't anything like for reference.
Oh, nothing relative.
And so they ended up having to reshoot a lot of the car stuff with people in the background just for some reference points, so you could see that they were really driving that fast.
So do you know, okay, when Aykroyd and Belushi are in the car and they're like hanging their heads out the windows and stuff, like, I mean, it looked like it meshed pretty well, but there's no way they were really driving that fast, right? In a real car? Like,
I'm not saying they didn't do any of the driving, but I would, you know, I'm not sure, but I would think they almost had to be using stunt drivers for most of
that. I couldn't imagine. Yeah. But I mean, it looked actually really good when they were like, you know, it's the front of the car windshield and they're like in the car and sticking their head out the windows and stuff. Like, it didn't look like a Lucy and Desi driving down the street behind, you know, video screen behind them. It looked, I mean, they did a really good job.
Yeah, I don't think they did. I mean, I think that they were probably really capturing that, but like maybe that was probably edited into the stunt driving. It just was done really well, so it felt organic. You know,
yeah,
I mean?
I wonder if they were driving at like 30 miles an hour, which still looked well because or fast because they were so zoomed in to just them, and then they zoom out to 100 miles an hour.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it looked really real, and I'm like, wow, kudos to them if they really, you know, were able to capture them driving and doing those, you know, because again, today with liability, I mean, they would never let A-list actors do that kind of stuff.
No.
And Aykroyd's a car nut, so, you know, like he, you know, like that was part of the, like in the, did you watch the theatrical cut or the director's cut, the extended version?
I'm sure it was theatrical, so both these were on Stars.
Okay. The extended version isn't radically different, but there's a couple other scenes. There's a scene where Dan Aykroyd, where Elwood quits his job. It's like the only time I think you see him without
That was in the, which cut?
That's the extended.
Then that's the one that I saw.
Okay, and that's the only time you see him without his glasses on, I believe. And
it was weird.
Yeah, and then there's also a scene where he pulls the car. You see him park the car like in this really tight, like alleyway or something. And
yeah, it does like a 360.
Yeah, and like originally, I don't think that's in the theatrical cut, but originally, like he had this whole thing about. This whole subplot about how they take the car and they park it, but they park it next to like a transformer station for Chicago Electric. And then somehow that supercharges the car. And then that's why the car can do all these crazy flips and stuff. And
was wondering why it was jumping over things like that.
Yeah. Like, and so like he had this whole like storyline for that. And like, and it was in the script and they started to film some of it and then they stopped, and he's trying to explain this to Landis, and Landis is basically like, yeah, how about it's just a magic car?
There you go.
Yeah, that works. We'll go with that.
It's a lot easier. It's already it's over 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I was wondering about, you know, I know that it's like part of their character and has definitely become it, but I was wondering if they always kept their glasses on because they were all coked up.
Oh,
so you don't see their bloodshot eyes at all.
I mean, no, maybe. That's what they got Visine for. They got ways around that. They're not the first people to make a movie coked up.
Okay, I just
Robin Williams wouldn't
like...
have had a career if if that's all it took to keep you out of a movie.
You get bloodshot eyes with coke?
I think so. I don't know.
I feel like if you do, I mean, if you're like on a you know, constant
a bender.
Yeah, I feel like your eyes get pretty bloodshot, and you can tell. But...
yeah, I guess maybe that's probably true.
Anyway,
It's also it's crazy to look at Belushi. It's one of those things where you look at Belushi and you know. How much of an influence on Farley he was, because everything Farley did. If you look at Tommy Boy or everything, I don't think where Belushi, I feel like, wanted to be like a serious actor. Farley had no interest in that. Farley, you know, I think I mean, it was Lorne Michaels. Somebody said that, like, I know this is sacrilege to say, but Farley was funnier than Belushi because Farley doubled down on the Farley wanted to be a comedian, where Belushi kind of had aspirations to be a serious actor. But just in, like, his mannerisms and his the way that he moves, like the scene in the church where he's doing the, not him doing the backflips, obviously, but like when Belushi lands for that.
Farley's backflips took a lot of influence from Belushi's backflips. There's a lot of that.
Yes, there's a lot of just in the way that he would deliver lines and everything.
Yeah.
Tom, I was saying that somebody had said that Farley was actually funnier than Belushi because Farley wanted to be a comedian and Belushi didn't. Not that Belushi didn't want to be a comedian, but he wanted to be like a legit actor.
Oh, so I see.
Farley doubled down on the comedy and he was just funnier than Belushi was naturally.
I don't know. He's building on what Belushi built though, too. You know what I mean?
He is. I'm just repeating what like somebody had said.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I definitely could see that. I can see the influence for sure from Belushi, but God, nobody had that energy level, like that manic energy level to match Farley.
That dude
was next level.
I think, and Farley definitely had the manic energy, don't get me wrong, but I think with Belushi, he had this way of like, he could be still, but still have that manic energy. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, for a performance that's pretty monotone, like, he is magnetic. And that's like, how do you walk that line between I'm going to be really monotone, I'm not going to over emote, I'm going to be really deadpan, and I'm going to hide my eyes, and still, like, he's got this energy that's just always bristling under the surface that you know is about ready to explode, which is what makes the musical number so great, is because that's when he finally gets to do it, and and then you're off to the races, and it just really makes those numbers pop in a way that, you know, and that's part of the hook, right? Is they're overly formal and they've got the suits and the sunglasses and they come on stage, even as a sketch, they come on stage so like just super serious, and then it's just boom and it's crazy time.
Yeah, I think of that scene in Animal House where the yuppie is playing guitar on the stairs, and he is so, like, he's very chill, and then he snaps and it's hilarious, and he gives the guy back the guitar and just goes back to being chill. So like, it's almost
that,
like,
guitar player is Stephen Bishop, who sang the theme to Tootsie, and he sang On and On, the Down in Jamaica They Got Lots of Pretty Women, and he also sang, that's him doing the falsetto version of Animal House in Animal House.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's funny. He almost got his head taken off in that scene.
He did.
Like, if Belushi swings that thing a centimeter lower, that guy does not have a career anymore.
Yeah, that was supposed to be a very SNL, Animal House, real quick, was supposed to be a very SNL-driven film. D-Day was supposed to be Dan Aykroyd. And then...
Oh, I could see that.
And then, what's the main guy's name? God dang it, I'm blanking on it, but Tim Matheson's character was supposed to be Chevy Chase. And so
makes complete sense.
Yeah, so it was supposed to be, and then the studio wanted Chevy Chase, but Landis didn't, and so
they never worked together, did they?
They kind of, I think Landis kind of convinced him to not take that role, and so then Chevy Chase went and made the movie Foul Play instead.
Oh, I like that movie.
It has not gone on to live on in our consciousness in the way that Animal House has, but it was absolutely a big hit, and Chevy Chase wanted to be like, he didn't want to be, that's how they kind of talked him out of it. It's like they like reverse psychology'd him. They were like, it's going to be great. We're going to get all the SNL guys back together. It's going to be you and Aykroyd and Belushi, and it'll be just like being on the show again. And with Chevy Chase, you know, I don't know if you know this, he has an ego. And
I had no idea.
And he wanted to be a movie star. He wanted to be a real, honest to God movie star. And so he didn't want to go slumming it in a movie like this. And so... it'd be around a bunch of other SNL people. He wanted to be in real Hollywood movies, and so
like the Three Amigos.
Well, I mean, eventually he gets past that. He gets past that because he makes a Oh Heavenly Dog, and he and then all of a sudden Caddyshack makes a lot more sense to him.
Yeah, right. So they get the band. They're going around. They're papering this whole town with flyers, and they have this. You know, the cops are on their tail, which is just like, I love the amount of police officers, National, all of the above, are chasing down the Blues Brothers throughout town.
And there's Nazis chasing them?
Illinois Nazis.
Because they mess up the Nazi parade, which I thought was great. Anytime you can throw some Nazis into the drink, the better.
Well, that's based on a real thing. You know that, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It becomes this massive road chase movie. And so the Blues Brothers get there on time. They get there late because, of course, while they're papering the town, they run out of gas. So they get to they do the gig and everything's going perfect. And now they make all of this money. And I think it's hilarious where the guy's like, you know, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen. And you guys were amazing. And he gives them he's like, we just need the $5,000. Give the rest of it to this thing and then give the rest to the band. And he was like, okay. So they get out. Now it's a race to get to the city assessor's office in Chicago because they have a deadline, right? Like, they have to get there by like 5 o'clock at this time. Well, now this is where the chase is insane. Like, they're being chased by every human being in the city of Chicago.
The build on this is great. Like, I mean, like, I think so many movies, when they want to have this epic car chase, they just go straight to the epic car chase where these guys have been picking up enemies throughout the film. So by the end, like you said, it's the cops and it's the Nazis and it's the guys from Bob's Country Bunker, and it's you know, it's like, it's, and then they call out the National Guard, and it just keeps building.
Do you think this created that? I mean, there's a lot of movies where, you know, in comedies they run into people along the way and then all of a sudden they're all chasing them like this. I wonder if it was the first to do that.
No, I don't think so. I think that's,
you don't think so?
I'm trying to think, and nothing's jumped, but I mean, I feel like that's a fairly kind of established thing and kind of like in, like, you know, kind of wacky comedies, but
it's a trope for sure where you've seen it a lot. And I just wondered, I can't remember an earlier one, but again, unless you know that fact, I just was thinking, oh, maybe it is the first, but it is always funny.
Honestly, I mean, it's a mad, 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 mad world kind of does it. Like, that's, you know, it's kind of,
sure they do. Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of doing that.
So now they get to this assessor's office, and it's a running gag where they're constantly blocking the doors, with different stuff, and they're running through the halls, and they get up to the city assessor's office. Just, you know, he'll be back in 5 minutes. Like, that's the sign on the door. So they're stuck waiting. And then who is the city assessor? But Steven Spielberg. And he's like, the guys are just like, this is for the church. And he's like, okay. And he hands them he takes the money. He gives them the receipt. And then as soon as they get the receipt, they get put back in the clink. They both are locked up. And that's kind of how this movie ends, is them just getting
the
cups.
Did we skip over Carrie Fisher?
Oh, we did. Yeah. So when they were leaving the gig, we find out that Carrie Fisher was Jake Blue's fiance, betrothed, and he left her, and she's pissed.
Left her at the altar.
Right. She's like, I was celibate
with all the guests and money,
5 years or whatever.
And so that's why she shoots a rocket launcher at him.
She shoots rifles and a flamethrower.
She has an assault rifle. Yeah, the flamethrower at the phone booth. Like, and I do like the zaniness of it. I mean, we talked last week about Gremlins, and especially Gremlins 2 being a live-action Looney Tunes. Like, in this movie, they do things where she shoots a flamethrower at a phone booth and it launches it into the air. Like,
she blows up an entire apartment building just to get to the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how this one ends, is them going to jail, and that's, you know, you get kind of like
a big musical number.
What's that, Tom?
And a big musical number. You end with Jailhouse Rock.
Yes, a massive musical number sung by all of the Blues people from the entire movie get their little bit pieces.
Yeah.
I've said before that my love of film come from the three Johns, Landis, Hughes, and Carpenter. And this, to me, this era of Landis is untouchable. He could do no wrong until Twilight Zone.
Oof.
Yeah. But like this era of comedy is my jam. Like he was the driving force behind these rated R comedies. And I think that you can see his progression even in this movie. There's no language. There's one N-bomb, but it comes from Cab Calloway.
Yeah. And there's, now I think there's, isn't there one F-bomb?
I don't think so.
I thought there was.
I think so because it's rated R because
is it rated
of
R?
Language. Yeah. It's rated R.
And
the
I think they
13.
I think they say dick at one point.
Okay.
But
there's
but,
like
but
it's not bad.
Overall by today's standards this is
PG-13.
This is PG-13. You know, I mean this is not for being you know, Belushi and Aykroyd and this kind of legendary kind of like, you know, college comedy that they used to call them back then. It's not, I mean, it's practically a family film. I mean, you can watch this with your kids. There's like I said, there's a couple cuss words, but I mean, unless you're really, that's important to you, your kids probably heard it said or heard you say it.
This has 9 uses of the F word and 25 uses of the S word.
Okay.
Oh man. Maybe I just feel like it just, I don't even hear them anymore. So,
it's the language. I mean, that's a lot of curse words.
But to your point, Joe,
yes,
for the 30th anniversary of this movie, the Vatican newspaper, I don't even know how to say this, La Lezvatore Romano.
Oh, nailed it.
Yeah.
Ooh, very good. Very good.
Is that, that's what I order at the Cheesecake Factory, I think.
I believe so. Yeah. And it's, but it's a Vatican newspaper, and it called the film a Catholic classic and recommended it as good viewing for Catholics.
I mean,
what?
They're helping to save an orphanage.
Oh my God. Wow. They must be desperate.
You know, like they're
they must
legally
be desperate for movies.
Well, I mean, well, they are, Kevin. They are. When movies like Spotlight come out, you're like, we got to get something. Can we get some sort of wholesome thing? Oh my God.
Just because they're like, yes, let's go and do this, legally earn this money, they recommend this movie.
I know, right?
Oh my God.
Pope John Paul II's like, did you see The Exorcist? We have to do something.
We've got to do something.
We are behind the eight ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a fantastic movie. I think it's fun. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's goofy. This is an interesting follow-up to Animal House. It would not consider a traditional follow-up to probably one of the greatest comedy rated R comedies of all time, but it's, I think it's fantastic. This movie is so much fun.
Yeah, it is. It's really good. So
I'm glad I've seen it. I just think you know, the blues stuff kind of, it just doesn't do it for me, and so I enjoyed it. I'm glad I've seen it. I don't know that I would go back to it, but I was impressed by the destruction and the car chase sequences. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, wild, crazy car chases were definitely a hallmark of 70s cinema. This is technically 1980, but it's, you know, it's still in that kind of parenthetical movement. So. But anyway, well, Blues Brothers is a lot of fun. It's interesting to see how it works for someone. Like, obviously, you know, Joe and I both bring nostalgia to it because we've been watching it for years. So it's interesting to see how someone takes it who is not coming at it with the prism of nostalgia.
I think we'll get into next episode even more so because they do more of it. But when they do musical performances, since I'm not that into blues music, like when I'm watching a movie, I don't want to watch a music video. I don't care about their blues performances because I don't care about that type of music. Again, and not maybe care isn't the right word. I don't enjoy it. Like,
it's just not your jam.
I don't seek it out. Yeah. So when each time they bust into a musical performance, I feel like I'm watching a music video, and it's like I'm there for the car chases, for the comedy, and so the more they do that, the more I get turned off by the movie, because that to me isn't what I go see movies for. So you know, I love musicals, but in a musical there's a lot of dancing and singing. Like, when in these movies, when they do blues performances, they're on a stage with instruments, you know, it's just literally like like a live performance.
They're capturing a live performance. Even if it's not on a stage, like in the music store, it's still them capturing a live performance.
Yeah, they're not doing the church scene was the closest to a musical when they're because they're,
oh, yeah,
people
big
are
time.
Choreographed dancing, flips down the aisle.
I think that one in the diner.
But then also the music store, all the dancing spills out into the street and they have that huge giant crowd out there.
That's true. No, that yeah. stuff is fine. Yeah. But it's just when they're on a stage performing, I'm just like, I'm just watching them. I'm watching a Blues Brothers music video. Like, right. I don't want musical sequences like that. I want, I would rather have more of the music store and the church and all that. So
right.
I think that was my biggest turnoff to the movie. But yeah, the comedy, the chemistry between the two of them. I mean, yeah, it was really good.
But I get what you're saying. When I go back and watch a Marx Brothers movie or an Abbott and Costello movie, I almost always end up fast forwarding through the musical numbers.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Like there were times, I mean, yeah, we'll get into it next time, but there were times where, I mean, I just straight up fast forwarded through the musical numbers because I didn't care. Like, I'm like, these aren't yeah. adding to the story. They're literally like, I could YouTube a music video of this song and just watch them perform it. It's a waste of time. Like, for the movie wise, I'm not getting anything from it. So yeah.
Well, it doesn't help that those musical numbers in the next one are so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're not bad, but they're not what you get, some of them are atrocious. Don't get me wrong, but some of them aren't awful, but they're not what you get in this. So,
right.
But,
that's true. Yes.
But so we will tackle that next time is what you have to look forward to. Blues Brothers 2000. So, until then, where can people find you guys?
You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, check out our Patreon, Patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. As you've been warned, coming up next time, we will tackle Blues Brothers 2000. Until then, Randolph has a heart attack.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.